Today on The World, we hear about tension building in Northern Ireland. Scenes are playing out again on the streets, reminiscent of decades past in a time known as the Troubles.
The young people who were ratting last night, none of these people were really born during the so-called Troubles here.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, there's a growing debate over sharing something quite precious, water from the Nile River.
The risk is that a political miscalculation by one side or the other would lead to a conflict which would then escalate.
And how wood is being reimagined as a new eco-building material.
The exciting part about engineered wood is it has similar properties to concrete and steel.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We start in Northern Ireland today. Where scenes are unfolding that are reminiscent of decades past. Last night in Belfast, rioters set fire to a hijacked bus and lobbed gasoline bombs at police. Others threw bricks over a concrete wall that divides Protestant British loyalist neighborhoods from Catholic Irish nationalist parts of town. It was the sixth consecutive night of violence. Anger in Belfast flared after Irish nationalists allegedly broke coronavirus restrictions for the funeral of a former leading IRA figure. Tensions have been on the rise since Britain's exit from the European Union upset Northern Ireland's unsteady political balance. Belfast City Councillor Matthew Collins was among those on the streets calling for calm. I asked him to describe what he saw last night.
Well, it was very worrying. There was a long and concerted riot in West Belfast, which is where I represent, and it's in an area where I live. And essentially, after a bit of a provocation from loyalists, a riot broke out from both ends, and there was a long-running battle where young people in particular were ratting, throwing stones, throwing everything they could get, including scores of petrol bombs, it seems, at one another. So it was a very serious situation. I was one of many community activists who was out trying to appeal for calm, trying to argue with young people to stay away, to stay at home, and to stay safe. Coming off the back of a pandemic that's lasted a year at a time when working class communities across Belfast are suffering, this is the last thing that we need to see.
What are the real issues at play here? You say, you know, it's a year after the pandemic, but what are the deeper issues that are sparking off this violence?
Well, I think the deeper issues are the dysfunctionality at the heart of the Northern Ireland state. It's a state that's based upon communal sectarianism. It's a state that's based upon a carve-up between orange and green politics. It's a state that's based upon institutionalization of sectarianism, despite, you know, this idea that the Good Friday Agreement kind of got beyond sectarianism and heralded a new day. I don't think that was ever the case. The young people who were ratting last night, none of these people were really born during the so-called Troubles here. They're the generation that were born after the peace process. Now, at the time when the peace process was signed, we were told that working class communities like this would see a peace dividend and that wealth would trickle down. I think they were sold a lie in that sense. So I think there's been a general frustration building up in working class communities.
So you're saying a lot of the causes of this unrest are deeper economic issues, that this new young generation, they aren't seeing the results of peace. They aren't seeing any economic benefits.
Well, I think that's the bigger context within which sectarianism occurs. But the primary cause of the riots last night was the stoking up of sectarian tensions from unionist politicians, but also, frankly, the intervention of loyalist groups who I think are orchestrating a lot of this violence behind the scenes. There's clear evidence emerging of paramilitary involvement. Paramilitary organizations are reactionary by nature, they're divisive by nature, and they only offer a more divisive future for the north of Ireland.
When you were out in the streets last night trying to calm things down, were people listening to you?
People may have listened, but they weren't taking our advice in large numbers. So when the trouble kicked off, I initially started trying to argue with some of the young people in the area that they should stay away and that they shouldn't reciprocate by throwing rocks and bottles back over the peace line. It didn't take very long to realize that that type of argument wasn't working. So most of them ignored it, but some of them did listen to it. And I think that that's important to stress. This is a minority of people who are getting involved in violence. I think for me, what's important to understand is that we have to call this out for what it is and we have to challenge it. And I was on the streets last night trying to challenge that. And I'll be on the streets again tonight if it emerges in the same way. But for me, the primary force that has stoked these type of tensions doesn't actually come from those young people. It comes from the establishment and government. I think that we have a situation here always, and it's recurrent in our history, where sectarianism primarily emerges from the top of society, but then it trickles down, and when it trickles down, it's working class people who suffer. And you can see that very clearly last night. It wasn't the wealthy, affluent areas that were having to deal with this disorder. It was the working class communities.
What is it going to take to prevent this situation from spiraling further out of control?
Well, I think we need to see immediate action. Last night, there was a bus driver attacked, a very disgraceful attack. His bus was hijacked and his life was put at risk. The bus was later burnt on the Shankill Road. Today, I joined bus workers in their hundreds who walked out of their workplace on strike and had a protest at Belfast City Hall in opposition to that type of violence. And I think that's the type of action, cross-community action based upon working class power, based upon uniting Catholic and Protestant workers from across this city to say no to sectarian division. And I think there's a hidden history of that throughout the history of the north of Ireland, of large groups of people getting together for their common interests, and in doing so, challenging sectarianism, challenging violence, and pointing the way for a new direction for the future.
Belfast City Councillor Matthew Collins, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now, a quick update on how COVID-19 vaccines are being distributed globally. More than 700 million doses have been administered, but it's very uneven. Here's WHO's director, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, earlier this week.
It is a travesty that in some countries, health workers and those at-risk groups remain completely unvaccinated.
Worldwide, dozens of countries, including Honduras, Taiwan, and Mali, have received less than 100,000 doses so far. The WHO says scaling up production is a major barrier. The main initiative to ensure that access is more equitable globally is called COVAX, and it faces an uphill journey. India, a main vaccine supplier for this effort, recently halted exports of the vaccine to focus on responding to its own massive outbreak. Still, COVAX is celebrating this week. Some 40 days into its launch, nearly 40 million doses have gone to 100 countries. That includes Afghanistan, Bolivia, and the latest this week, the small Caribbean island of St. Lucia.
The introduction of the COVID-19 vaccine is a major milestone in reducing coronavirus transmission and the burden of disease.
That was St. Lucia's National Immunization Manager, Tekla Habatis, speaking at a ceremony. The inequality in access is adding to the growing debate over so-called vaccine passports. As some businesses in England prepare to open up after months of lockdown, the UK government is considering putting in place a COVID certificate scheme later this year. But as the World's Orla Berry reports, the plan is making some serious political waves.
Pub owner Christian Burns in northeast England loves the idea of opening his doors to the public on Monday, but British weather isn't really cooperating.
Right now I'm looking out of my study window and it's brilliant sunshine, but it's 3 degrees and I'm looking at the ground with snowflakes on it. So who's going to sit in this next week?
Burns owns 10 pubs, but only 4 of them have outdoor beer gardens. That means legally, they're the only places allowed open next week. Burns pubs have been shut for 6 months because of lockdown rules, and he says it's been a struggle.
Horrendous. The bars that I've got have never been able to operate to their full potential since March the 23rd last year. We've had a year from hell.
Among those planning to visit a beer garden on Monday is none other than the British Prime Minister.
On Monday the 12th, I will be going to the pub myself and cautiously but irreversibly raising a pint of beer to my lips.
Boris Johnson was asked about the idea of putting in place a system of COVID status certificates, meaning that people would have to prove that they've been vaccinated or have a negative test result before they enter a shop, for example, or a pub. Johnson said that's not happening, at least not right away.
There is absolutely no question of people being asked to produce certification or COVID status on Monday.
But the Prime Minister didn't rule out the idea that these certificates might be introduced a few weeks down the road. And that's not going over well with lawmakers, including some of those from Johnson's own Conservative Party. They're accusing the Prime Minister of backtracking on a promise he made earlier this year to never introduce COVID certificates. Here's Conservative MP Desmond Swain speaking in Parliament.
After months of denial, now indeed it will be the case that you will have to provide your vaccination bona fides when you go to the pub. Undoubtedly, this will be extended to theatres, sporting venues, and so proceeding to total social control.
One problem with the scheme is that despite Britain's relatively successful vaccination campaign, the vast majority of those who've had the shot so far are over 50 years of age. And Christian Byrne says that rules out lots of his customers.
I think it's discriminatory because a lot of my target audience are under 40, and those guys are not going to be able to have that COVID certificate because they won't have been jabbed. So are you saying that only people over 50 are going to have that certificate to get in your bar?
But Byrne says he's not completely opposed to the idea that customers face some kind of testing regime. He says he'd be happy to test his clientele himself. And if they prove they're COVID negative, then social distancing should not be enforced in pubs, he says. The UK government has planned to do a trial run with COVID status certificates later this month at a number of events, including major football matches and the World Snooker Championship. Live theatre shows are also reported to be under consideration. Nika Burns runs several theatres in London's West End. She's reopening next month with social distancing in place. But she's hoping that's just one step towards getting back to normal.
Whatever system the government decides on to enable theatres to get back up to 100% capacity, we will implement as venues. We need to get the industry up. We can't open most of the shows with social distancing because economics don't work.
I ask Nika Burns if customers will be bothered going to the theatre if they're expected to produce a negative COVID test every time.
Some people really do want to go back to the theatre, Orla, so yes.
While businesses might be mulling over the best way to open up again, civil liberty groups say COVID status certificates are a slippery slope. Mark Johnson is legal and policy officer with Big Brother Watch.
It would be effectively like a license to exist. You're having to prove to people around you that you're safe. There's nothing more private than your own health, and this idea that you should have to disclose health ID just to access society is overbearing and could lead to other kinds of health ID in the future.
Opposition politicians also say that COVID certificates would create a two-tier society and discriminate against those who can't get the jab. Between disgruntled Conservative MPs and members of the opposition, Boris Johnson's government faces an uphill battle to make COVID status certificates a reality. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Despite the pandemic and global lockdowns, greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere still reached an all-time high in 2020. That's according to preliminary annual numbers from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
The headline really is that carbon dioxide and methane have hit historically high levels because of anthropogenic or human emissions.
Researcher Arlen Andrews leads the team that makes the measurements. Methane saw its highest year-over-year increase since comprehensive records began more than a generation ago.
Methane surprises us all the time, and the rate of increase has been very high since about 2014, and this year was especially high.
Methane comes both from human sources, like oil and gas burning, and from natural sources, like wetlands and melting permafrost. Andrews says it's hard to pinpoint the source of this year's jump, but it's troubling.
It's about 28 times more powerful than CO2 at trapping heat when you can kind of consider a 100-year time frame.
Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increased at a slower rate last year due to lockdowns, but the NOAA researcher says the total concentration in the atmosphere is higher than ever because CO2 hangs around for centuries.
You can think of it like trash accumulating in a landfill, where if you put less trash in the landfill, the pile still gets larger.
Andrews says a year-long economic slowdown isn't going to make a dent.
The only way that we would actually see atmospheric carbon dioxide start to decrease is if we reduced our emissions to near zero.
Coming up, the carbon footprint of the construction industry and a building material that may help. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Building materials are a significant source of greenhouse gas pollution. Steel and concrete alone account for more than 10% of CO2 emissions globally. Enter a hot new eco-building material, a reimagined version of something you've probably already heard of. That's today on The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Building with wood has been reinvented, and the world's Anna Kussmer reports that a new class of materials seems poised to take off.
When I started reporting a story on eco-building, I didn't expect to talk to the owner of a UK football club.
We're the greenest football club in the world, according to FIFA and the United Nations.
Dale Vince's team is the Forest Green Rovers in Gloucestershire in southwest England. They have solar panels on the roof and vegan meals for the team. Now they're designing one of the most eco-friendly stadiums in the world.
By choosing wood, we will have the lowest carbon footprint stadium since the Romans invented concrete.
The stadium will be made out of something called mass timber, which is a catch-all term for engineered wood cut into slabs and then stacked together to make strong panels or beams. It's made in factories like this one in western Sweden, where hundreds of planks are being cut and fit together into prefabricated walls. The special engineering makes the wood really strong, says Anne Coven, director of the Mass Timber Institute in Toronto.
The exciting part about engineered wood is it has similar properties to concrete and steel, and therefore the opportunity is now available to build tall wood buildings.
The timber can replace the steel and concrete in a building, cutting its carbon footprint by a quarter to nearly a half. In the last two decades, hundreds of mass timber projects have been built around the world, from high-rises in Norway to university buildings in Singapore to hotels in the U.S. But Coven says for the industry to expand, it needs to move beyond boutique projects.
What mass timber needs right now is a sort of bread and butter building so that gas stations and restaurants and variety stores and malls and so forth will start using mass timber.
Mass timber expert Mathieu Robert says the industry is poised for that to happen.
I have 20 years in that field. I never see such a momentum. Never. In the last 4 or 5 years, it's just booming.
Robert is an engineer for mass timber manufacturer Stora Enso. Mass timber is a more expensive building option for now. And in the past, entrenched industry interests have sponsored efforts to exclude it from the International Building Code, which most U.S. jurisdictions use. But this year, the code was updated to allow mass timber structures up to 18 stories to be built. And new regulations in Europe targeting building emissions could give wood options a boost, like a new rule in France requiring builders to calculate the 50-year carbon footprint of new construction.
So we are looking at the entire lifetime of the building, and that's really great. So you start by having a regulation on carbon, and then you can incentivize that.
Injoneel Ganguly at the University of Washington studies the environmental impact of wood products. He says about 10% of new buildings in the U.S. use steel and concrete and could start being built with mass timber. But elsewhere in the world, that number could be a lot higher.
This story changes dramatically when we go to China, where we only build with concrete and steel.
But it's only a climate win if the timber is harvested sustainably in the first place. Mass timber is mostly made out of softwood, evergreen trees like fir and spruce. If the industry does boom, it could lead to unchecked deforestation.
The regions that worry me is deforestation that may happen in Russia or Ukraine.
Places with a lot of evergreen trees.
If we start procuring wood unsustainably from those places, then that's a problem.
It's unclear where the wood will come from for the Forest Green Rovers new soccer stadium in Gloucestershire. Designers are thinking Austria, Germany, or France. Owner Dale Vince says he can't wait to introduce fans to the new space, where wood will feature everywhere, from the walkways to the concession areas to the seats.
The sustainable development across the whole site will push the boundaries of what's possible and what's thought to be possible and what's been done before. And we'll demonstrate a different way to live and a different way to do things.
He says he hopes in the next few years, the stadium will be built and filled with vegan food and screaming fans. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
Water is life, but it's also a matter of national security. In Egypt this week, the president said, don't touch a drop of Egypt's water because all options are open. A not-so-veiled threat to Ethiopia over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. The dam will divert the waters of the Nile River. Talks between Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan fell apart this week, and here's why.
Egypt has long regarded the Nile as essential to its existence.
Alex DeWall is an expert on the Horn of Africa at Tufts University. He spoke about the dam project with my colleague Marco Werman.
Everywhere around the world, water is precious. Take the Nile River. It either runs through or borders 11 nations. Each one depends on the river for its water supply. Three of those countries, Sudan, Ethiopia, and Egypt, are currently engaged in talks on how best to share the water. These discussions were prompted by Ethiopia's construction of a dam. Ethiopia says the dam is needed to lift its citizens out of poverty. Egypt is viewing it with suspicion. Alex DeWall joins me to talk about this. He's an expert on the Horn of Africa and the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University. What can you tell us, Alex, about these negotiations so far and how they've been going?
It originates with the fact that Egypt has long regarded the Nile as essential to its existence, and that all the upstream countries should, as it were, have secondary rights to the Nile waters. A couple of years ago, the young, energetic, reformist Ethiopian Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, who'd recently won the Nobel Prize, overplayed his hand. He felt, okay, I am now a world-renowned peacemaker. I can do a deal anywhere. And he went and met directly with the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and offered to talk directly.
How did President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi take it?
He must have thought Christmas had come early, that his strategic adversary in the Nile Basin was yielding a very strong hand and saying, okay, we'll play on your terms. Because al-Sisi then took it to the Trump administration, said, let's have the U.S. as the mediator. And in the very transactional world of Trumpian politics, Egypt had more to offer than Ethiopia. So suddenly, Ethiopia found itself isolated. And the terms of the deal that were then on offer were not very favorable to Ethiopia. So Ethiopia backtracked. And since then, Prime Minister Abiy has been trying to retrieve his position and trying to garner a better deal. Whereas, well, Egypt can, as it were, turn the screws on Ethiopia, which is now in a much weaker position, in order to get a deal that it likes.
So why is this dam so important to Ethiopia?
Well, the Ethiopian philosophy of the developmental state, which has now actually ironically been cast aside by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed in favor of a market economy, the Ethiopian developmental strategy needed electricity. And the best way of generating electricity was hydropower. Ethiopia is a highland country, has a lot of rivers running through it, and can generate a lot of power.
So basically, Egypt does not want to see the Nile slow down. What do you think Egypt is willing to do if some agreement is not reached?
I think Egypt has strong cards in its hand, and in fact, the dam, if managed in a agreed manner, can be an asset to both countries. It can actually store water at a high altitude in the Ethiopian highlands where less will evaporate. It can regulate the water flow. It shouldn't be a threat, but it has to be managed by agreement. And one of the challenges to the Biden administration that is about to appoint a high-level special envoy for the Horn of Africa will be to take over the mediation on this dispute and try and find a satisfactory agreement that accommodates the interests of all the parties here. Technically speaking, that isn't difficult to do. The formula can be found. The problem is the politics, and the particular problem at the moment is that the Ethiopian government has embroiled itself in a series of unnecessary wars. We know about the civil war in Tigray and its devastating impacts. It's also got itself into a border conflict with Sudan. And it's, I think the fear in Washington, D.C. is that the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed, has proved so unreliable, so reckless, that he might inadvertently blunder into another conflict with Egypt. And that would be calamitous.
Alex, as you know, conflicts around the globe have been fought over water. If an agreement isn't reached in this situation, is war a possibility? Is fighting a possibility?
Fighting is a possibility. It's a possibility less because there is a rational logic for fighting over the Nile. It is possible for the Nile waters issues to be solved in an amicable way that benefits everybody. But the risk is that a political miscalculation by one side or the other would lead to a conflict which would then escalate into something much more serious.
Alex DeWall is an expert on the Horn of Africa. He's also the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University here in Massachusetts. Thank you, Alex.
You are very welcome.
You're listening to The World. New Zealand is pioneering a new law that will affect thousands of people in the country, paid time off for people who have suffered a miscarriage.
Although miscarriage is actually really, really common, I totally wasn't expecting or prepared to lose it, and I really did feel a very strong sense of grief.
Time to recover from the loss, still ahead, here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. New Zealand is seen as a leader in advancing progressive policies, especially since New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern took office in 2017. The latest example came last week when a law took effect requiring employers to offer paid time off for people who have a miscarriage. The law will affect thousands of people each year in New Zealand, and it all started with a letter from a woman experiencing her own loss. The World's Bianca Hillier has the story.
Catherine Van Beek lives in Dunedin, a city in southern New Zealand. It was 2016 when she had a miscarriage.
We'd done all the things like gone and seen the baby on the screen and heard its heartbeat and started preparing its nursery and all that kind of stuff. So although miscarriage is actually really, really common, I totally wasn't expecting or prepared to lose it. And I really did feel a very strong sense of grief.
Catherine says she wasn't in a position to immediately return to work as a school communications advisor. So she started looking into her legal rights and realized there wasn't anything specific in New Zealand law about bereavement leave for pregnancy loss before 20 weeks. Instead, it was up to employees to talk with their employers about if they qualified for bereavement leave.
And I just thought that would just be a terrible conversation to have when you were in that position of grieving, particularly if you were declined.
Fortunately, Catherine's employer did offer support at the time, but it was an arduous process and she wanted to do something about it.
So I wrote a letter to my MP, Claire Curran, which in retrospect was quite a heartfelt letter, and she invited me into her offices to have a chat.
That chat began a years-long journey. Catherine's Member of Parliament asked her to gather testimonials from thousands of Kiwis who said they would have benefited from paid time off after a miscarriage.
Some people had not had very nice responses from their employers at all. And other interesting experiences where perhaps there were two people in a partnership and the guy was given bereavement leave by his employment, but maybe the woman wasn't. So there were all these little interesting niggly stories.
Those stories helped form the legislation that was unanimously approved by New Zealand lawmakers at the end of March. MP Ginny Anderson made a passionate speech in Parliament that day.
The grief that comes with miscarriage is not a sickness, Mr. Speaker. It is a loss. And that loss takes time. Time to recover physically and time to recover mentally.
Catherine was in the audience watching. During the speech, Ginny Anderson credited her with the bill's progress.
We would not have been here without you, Catherine. Thank you for your voice, your strength, and your advocacy. This is your bill.
The bill, now law, provides 3 days of bereavement leave to people who miscarry. Other countries are fighting for similar legislation and are hoping to build off of New Zealand's momentum. In Ireland, Labour Senator Ivana Bacik recently introduced a bill which would allow 20 days of paid leave for miscarriages. Similar to New Zealand politicians, Senator Bacik says Ireland needs this because people shouldn't have to use their sick leave to recover from a miscarriage. And
also it's to try and break the taboo around fertility, infertility and miscarriage, because for far too long employees have felt unable to discuss with employers or colleagues about this issue.
Stigma surrounding miscarriages is an inextricable piece of this conversation, and it's part of the reason why the dialogue continues worldwide, even in countries that already have legal protections, like India, where they have a maternity benefits law.
The maternity benefit law in India is a fairly old law, right? It goes back to your 1960s.
That's Vandita Mararka, a human rights lawyer in Mumbai and the founder of One Future Collective, a social justice organization in India. She says for decades, Indian law has required that employers offer 6 weeks of paid time off after pregnancy loss. Vandita says it's a progressive and comprehensive piece of legislation. If only it were implemented.
The compliance towards it is fairly low. People find loopholes, people find ways to keep employees on certain contracts, never tell them about their rights, which is why most people don't know that this is a right they have.
Under Indian law, employers are required to pay for the bereavement leave. Vandita says she understands how small companies with just a handful of employees would struggle to do that. But she hasn't even seen reasonable accommodation in those situations. And major corporations often find ways to work around the law, too. Receiving the 6 weeks of paid time off is supposed to be a right. Instead, Vandita says it's more like a privilege.
You know, I'm not just thinking about people who work in, like, fancy high rises in Bombay, but I'm also thinking about, like, factory workers, about domestic workers. In places like factories and stuff, these laws are never truly realized.
Unions and educating people about their rights would really help, Vandita says, in addition to harsher penalties when companies fail to comply. Back in New Zealand, Catherine Van Beek says she doesn't think her country's new legislation will fully break the stigma surrounding miscarriage. But the recognition the law provides and the discourse it has already started is what she would have liked after her own miscarriage years ago.
Because it's such a strange loss, there's no funeral, there's no ritual, so it's very invisible. And just to be seen by society and have an actual law that says, yes, you did go through a loss, and if you're feeling sad, that's completely okay, would have meant the most to me.
Catherine added she was lucky her local MP replied to her letter, and she encourages other people to take that chance, because you never know what change it could make. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The Biden administration made a significant announcement yesterday that it would restore more than $200 million in American aid for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. It's the strongest move yet to reverse the Trump administration's position that favored Israeli interests and halted diplomacy with the Palestinians. Hussein Ibish is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. He was a fellow at the former American Task Force on Palestine and knows how aid from the U.S. is used in the Palestinian territories. Hussein Ibish, how much money is being promised by the Biden administration and how will it be delivered?
Okay, so it adds up to something like $270 million when you put together COVID relief funding that's already gone, which is not much, but it's some, and then additional COVID funding, $150 million for UNRWA, which is the UN agency that cares for Palestinian refugees, and some money for economic development assistance in the West Bank and Gaza, which goes through USAID and a couple of other U.S. agencies. And all of it is going to be done through U.S. or international agencies. None of it goes to the Palestinian Authority or anything controlled by Palestinians.
How is this current amount of aid that we're now talking about, around $270 million, how is it to be used? I mean, who gets the money and how does it actually help Palestinians?
Okay, so the economic development stuff will go to mostly to specific dedicated projects that are vetted through, approved by, and controlled in effect by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, which is connected to the State Department. And then there's the money that goes to UNRWA. UNRWA is run by the UN. They do humanitarian assistance. So they do food and medicine and schooling, the basic needs of life. No one else really cares for Palestinian refugees. Most of the people of Gaza, 80% or something of the population of Gaza, are refugees from southern Israel. They need UNRWA. They need health and food security aid and schooling and whatnot from UNRWA, or else they don't really get it.
So did they not get it in the past 3 years when the aid was cut off?
They often either they got substandard schooling or less schooling. And certainly what happened is a lot of people got fired. I mean, UNRWA, among other things, is a major employer, right? So a lot of people who worked for UNRWA, Palestinians working as teachers, as administrators, etc., within the UNRWA education system, health system, they've been furloughed. They've been fired, on leave, etc. The Palestinian economy is small. One of the biggest challenges is getting people jobs and getting those people paid. UNRWA is one of the major employers in a place like Gaza and in Palestinian refugee camps.
Now, as you know, this is a solemn day in Israel. It's Holocaust Remembrance Day. The Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Gilad Erdon, he said UNRWA, the U.N. agency we've been talking about, the U.N. Relief and Works Agency, is responsible for inciting anti-Israeli sentiment. What is he referring to?
I think what he really means is that by caring for the refugees, UNRWA allows the refugees to continue to exist as refugees. In other words, it supports them, right? And because of that, they don't scatter to the five winds and forget about their Palestinian identity, and they stay where they are, and they remain insistent on their identity and their communities. And this, I think, Israelis regard as existentially threatening. UNRWA helps to solidify the definition, to codify who is a refugee, and to care for them as refugees.
Now, the Biden administration, as we said, has restored this money to the Palestinians. What does that move mean to Palestinians themselves?
Okay, it's very symbolically, it's very important. Even though it doesn't resume or restore diplomatic relations between the United States and the PLO, which is basically the foreign ministry of the Palestinians, or direct U.S. support for the Palestinian Authority, their quasi-government in the occupied territories, it does recognize the Palestinians as a people with interests that are an international and an American concern, right? It's not that we're responsible, no one else is, but we want to participate in that, that we care about whether children have health care and people have food and whether COVID relief is going on in this very beleaguered place that's been under a military occupation since the 1960s. And it sends a very important message. We do, not only in theory, but in practice, with word and deed, recognize your existence. And that's very important.
Hussein Ibish is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. He's been speaking to us about Palestinian reaction to the resumption of U.S. aid. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
For decades, the city of Buenaventura on the Pacific coast of Colombia has been a major crossing point for legal and illegal trade. It's also considered one of the most violent cities in the country. In 2014, the Colombian military intervened, providing some stability, but that's now deteriorating, with violence increasing in much of the city as criminal groups fight for turf. Many residents are unable to speak out because they're scared of becoming targets. From Buenaventura, Stephen Gritan reports.
In the scorching heat, children play among the garbage and rubble in a protected neighborhood in Buenaventura, known as the Puente Nayero Humanitarian Space. It's a grassroots effort led by residents of the city who have fought back against the gangs. The neighborhood is made up of wooden houses on stilts above water. There's a potent stench from the raw sewage which runs underneath. But it is a safe space for the many victims of violence who now inhabit it, patrolled 24/7 by the military. It used to be the site of gruesome chop houses, where armed groups would dismember and dispose of their victims in the nearby sea. Resident Naibe Angulo's husband was disappeared 3 years ago, and she and her sons had to move.
Es un temor profundo.
It's a profound fear, she says. Angulo now advocates for victims of displacement, putting her life at risk to do so. She told me she and some other activists have received threatening leaflets by armed groups over recent weeks.
No es nada comparado. Era preferiblemente estar con la pandemia del COVID.
She says we'd prefer to be with the COVID pandemic than with this pandemic of horrible violence we live through in Buenaventura. Former priest Adriel Ruiz Galvan runs a victims' memorial center filled with relics and photos of those who have lost their lives in Buenaventura's violence.
Este espacio se llama la Capilla de la Memoria. Es un lugar simbólico.
The space is known as the Chapel for Memory, he says, created as an exercise of symbolic reparation in the face of the violence in the city. Buenaventura has been one of the municipalities where around 80% or more is a direct victim of conflict. Galvan himself has a security team. The root of the recent violence is a war between two rivaling groups, Los Chotas and Los Espartanos, who broke off from the now defunct La Local. When 7 young people were killed by their clashes in December last year, the conflict intensified. A local theatre group reenacts stories of violence and displacement. All have experienced it firsthand. 45-year-old Ana Mosquera takes part.
De verdad que nos preocupa mucho la situación por la cual estamos pasando.
We're really worried about the situation right now, she says, and that it's always been like this, but now it's become much more visible because of the recruitment of young people into armed groups. Like the dozens of residents I spoke to in Buenaventura, she's angry at the government for forgetting them.
El gobierno estatal para Buenaventura solo ha sido...
Buenaventura has just been a place where politicians come at election time to try and get votes. She says they come, they do their campaign, and they leave. Despite its crucial role as a port, unemployment is sky high, and 80% of people in Buenaventura live in poverty. The overwhelming majority of residents are Afro-Colombian, who have long felt marginalized by the government. Jimena Sanchez is with the Washington Office on Latin America think tank.
Unfortunately, I think that the government is not going to heed the call to take action and do the right thing. Rather, I think that the government is going to gloss over the situation and continue to blame the locals and stigmatize them and say that this is a situation of criminality. And unfortunately, that may lead to a resurgence of the strike again in the port.
Locals have been calling on the president to come to the city for months to implement a special security plan to stop the ongoing violence, killings and disappearances in the region. Last month, he sent Defense Minister Diego Molano to announce that more police will be deployed. But locals say militarization is not the answer and more attention needs to be put on social issues like creating job opportunities. 29-year-old activist Leonard Rentiera is also escorted by two bodyguards in an armoured car around town. At just 5'2", the pint-sized rapper expresses his anger about the violence and inequality that remains in the city today through music. At the age of 9, Rentiera and his family had to move due to violence.
Bueno, yo empecé casi cuando tenía 14 años en el tema del rap.
He says he started rapping when he was 14 because there were so many things to say about what goes on here, and the easiest way to say it was through music, through rap. He was displaced again when he was 21, and 2 years later at 23, when a family member was killed by gunmen. Those stories are in his lyrics.
Por supuesto, cuando yo digo que... He
says, when I talk about coming with my family displaced from my land after a long walk to another land we arrived, I am telling the story of what happened to many families. Many have been displaced from their territory. Rentiera told me most people are paralyzed by fear to speak out, but not him. People end up saying nothing and suffering in silence. I get scared, but I speak freely and with conviction, because someone has to. Rentiera sends this message to Colombian President Iván Duque.
Al gobierno yo le diría que Buenaventura también es Colombia.
Buenaventura is Colombia too. We too have been part of building this country, and we've fought hard so that this port produces for the country. For the world, I'm Stephen Gratton in Buenaventura, Colombia.
Today is Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. In Israel, sirens blared for 2 minutes and everything came to a standstill in memory of the 6 million Jews who perished. At the Knesset Parliament building,
Savati she'al shma nikruya, Esther Steinbrecher, Biladea Malka lebat ha'shesh u'muni yakben ha'shmone,
lawmakers read out the names of family members who were killed by the Nazis. This day is observed by Jewish communities worldwide to remember the victims and honor the survivors. Jack Rosenthal is a survivor. He grew up in a tiny town in the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains in Romania, the oldest of 6 children and the only one in his family to survive. He was deported to Auschwitz in Poland in 1944 and then force-marched to Buchenwald concentration camp in Germany, where he was liberated at the end of the war. Today, Jack is in his 90s. He's also the grandfather of one of our reporters, Sarah Birnbaum. Sarah usually talks to her grandfather, or Zaidi as she calls him, on FaceTime every week.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for doing this.
Well, I have to tell the story, if not me, who else?
On this Holocaust Remembrance Day, after a year of COVID and when so many Holocaust survivors are gone, she recorded the call to let us eavesdrop just a little.
So how many years has it been since you were in the camps now?
Well, I was liberated in 1945. So that would be 55, 76 years.
Can you believe it's that long ago?
To me, it's not long. It's like I think about it almost every day. So
you do?
It's still in my mind. It's very sharp in my mind. At one time, I almost forgot it, but now it old age, it comes back more often.
There are fewer survivors these days. I remember as a little kid going with you to that big Holocaust memorial.
There was a time when we used to meet in Madison Square Garden. There were so many. And later on, we met in the Temple Emmanuel on 59th Street in Manhattan, the big synagogue, but it used to close down the street. So that's how many people there were. Today, like in my shul today, I'm the only male survivor of the Holocaust. The rest of them are all gone. There used to be about 28, 30 people, survivors.
I remember, as you say that some of your best friends died this year, who are also Holocaust survivors.
Many of my friends died.
Are you thinking about Jack and Joe this year a lot? Because you guys really banded together.
Usually after the war, we were like family. We used to have meetings in various places. There used to be thousands or hundreds who would come from all over the United States. And we felt like family.
I think a lot about when I was 12 or 11 and we went back to your hometown in Romania. Like, I almost never have seen you happier. I don't know. You just kind of seemed light.
I was glad that I took you there. At least you'll have an idea where I come from, which was a plain village. There were no trains, no buses. As a matter of fact, the first time I rode a train is when they took me to Auschwitz. It was a backward thing, but we had our own history. We had our own culture. There were sometimes good times there.
I do want to ask you about COVID. It seemed almost cruel to me that a lot of survivors who are alive now have to go through this year.
One thing I always thought to myself, I don't mind dying already, but I mean, I wouldn't say I don't mind. I mean, everybody wants to live, but I would like to die in dignity. But most of those people that died in COVID, they died by themselves in a hospital. It was very cruel. Something like this shouldn't happen. So I have something against the Lord.
Just one thing, though.
Just one thing, yeah. The rest of them, I'll forgive them.
Anything else, Saidi?
Anything I want to tell you is the one you should take care of yourself and the family.
I love you.
I love you, too. I love everybody. And I love my great-grandchildren, which is something which is... I'm very grateful that I live to see the day to have great-grandchildren. Okay.
Okay, I love you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Holocaust survivor Jack Rosenthal speaking with his granddaughter, the world's Sarah Birnbaum. A little music for you now, a song from Brazil that begins with a soft heartbeat.
Teu coração bate juntinho ao meu, bate pra aquecer uma vida inteira, nova história pra contar.
This is cellist and singer-songwriter Dominique Pinto. Her stage name, Dom La Nena, means Dom the Little Girl in Portuguese. She was a cello prodigy as a girl, but today Dom La Nena is judged for her art, not her age. This song is Teu Coração, or Your Heart. Your heart beats close to mine, sings Dom La Nena as she plucks her cello. She was pregnant when she composed this song and many of the other tracks on her new album, Tempo. But there's a line in it that feels like it's not about a newborn, but rather her native Brazil, which is hurting badly from the pandemic. This week, Brazil surpassed 4,000 deaths in a single day from COVID and could potentially surpass the U.S. in its total death toll. From Dom La Nena, she offers these words of hope. A beautiful day is coming. With a flower blooming.
Um belo dia vai nascer como uma flor desabrochar.
Brazilian-born, Paris-based musician Dom Lanena, with music from her new album, Tempo. Working from home, the kids, the dog, yep, it's exhausting. But you can always listen to The World on your own time, subscribe to our latest edition podcast, find us on your favorite podcast app, or at theworld.org/podcast. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.
Teu coração bate juntinho ao meu, bate pra aquecer uma vida inteira, tanta história pra contar, e eu fico aqui.